This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. JP Morgan Chase, the nation's largest bank, on Monday became even bigger after it bought First Republic Bank, a San Francisco-based regional bank. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, brokered the sale after it was revealed that First Republic had lost $100 billion in deposits. It's the second bank to face collapse this year after Silicon Valley Bank folded in March, and it has sparked fears that more regional banks will follow. Economists point out that consumer spending is finally slowing down as inflation remains high and as tech and media industries are cutting tens of thousands of jobs. Joining me to discuss the state of the economy is Doug Henwood, a political economist, host of Behind the News, a weekly radio show at KPFA. He's the author of several books, including Wall Street, After the New Economy, and My Turn. Welcome back to the program after a long time, Doug.
Yeah, it's been too long. I missed you. Always like being on your show.
Thank you. Thanks so much. Likewise, always a pleasure to have you on. So are the fears overblown? I feel like I can count on you to tell me whether there's going to be a run on deposits. I have a cousin who's a bit of a conspiracy theorist who is panicking and telling me to take all my money out of the bank, not that I have much. But how do you respond to these supposed fears?
Well, just be careful with the portion of your bank deposits over $250,000. So,
good. I would have no worries then.
I think there's an unusually large share of the banking system consists now of uninsured deposits. It got pretty low in the 90s. I was just looking at a report the FDIC released yesterday, I believe. Showed like in the 90s, it was only about 10% of bank deposits were uninsured, that is, above the insurance limit. But now it's like 46% to be precise, but yeah, it's approaching half. Very high. We haven't been this high since, it's actually rivaling the early days of the bank insurance system. So it's risky. And there's an awful lot of uninsured deposits. The anxiety among the regulators is that if some of the uninsured depositors take a hit, people will panic and withdraw all that money, and then that will only make the problem worse. Then the question is, why should these people get a free ride? Capitalism is supposed to be about discipline and the risk of loss. And if these people are insured against that kind of loss, then capitalism is not working as it should. And so it causes real problems. If you have all these people who feel rather complacent about putting all this money at risk and then having the government pick up the tab. But on the other hand, yeah, the risks are real. So we're kind of in a box, just as we're in a box in the whole interest rate situation. 10 years or more of close to 0% interest rates as interest rates return to more normal levels, which are still low relative to inflation. This also provides a whole new set of risks that we haven't seen before. So yeah, this is a strange situation we're in.
And
the economy looks
about
to be slowing down, but it's not, it's not on the verge of collapse or anything.
So I want to discuss each of these things in a little bit more detail, just going back to the issue of deposits that are insured, and to make it clear to our audience, not everybody is well versed in economic jargon. And when you keep your money in the bank, your hard-earned money in the bank, if your bank has is FDIC insured, which might be a term that a lot of people might have seen, on the window of their bank, it means that if that bank collapses, the federal government will step in and make sure that you don't lose all your money. And we sort of assume that that's going to be the case with most banks and most of our money. But you're saying that something like half of banks are now not FDIC insured. How did that happen?
No, it's not the banks. It's that the deposits are above that $250,000 maximum. Yeah, so the FDIC guarantees bank deposits up to $250,000.
All bank deposits.
After that, you're on your own. And so there's an awful lot that's above that $250,000 limit now. In the bank failures of the 80s, and there were hundreds and hundreds of bank failures back in the 1980s, uninsured depositors did take a hit, but this time around, they're not. And I think the concern is, as I said, this growth in the large percentage of deposits that are above the insurance limit, and what to do about that is a problem. The FDIC report that I was just quoting earlier suggests maybe more targeted coverage, for example, insuring businesses that have their transaction accounts at amounts above $250,000, but insuring them but excluding individuals with money above $250,000, because there's probably no reason a regular person needs over $250,000 in the bank. And if you're a business that needs to make payroll, you might need to have that amount. But if you're a person, you know, you should think about something else, like a treasury bills or money market funds or something.
Or if you're maybe a retired person who's built up a nest egg and are counting on those deposits getting you through to the end of your life. And of course, maybe that is the case with a number of folks, but I imagine that it is primarily the very wealthy that this affects.
Yeah, and well, businesses too. You know, a lot of the uninsured right. deposits at Silicon Valley Bank were businesses just with their regular transaction accounts. Yeah. And for a business of any size to have over $250,000 is not outlandish. Right. So that's a different consideration from somebody who's maybe reckless or. But if you've got that much money, if you're just a person saving for retirement, you're better off, just putting the money in treasury bills or treasury bonds or in sound mutual funds and not keeping it above the insurance limit at the bank.
Now, let's talk about interest rates. You mentioned that interest rates are still historically low, and yet the Federal Reserve has been raising rates in an effort to curb inflation raising rates pretty high, but that's high compared to zero, right? So they're still quite low. Has the action of raising interest rates actually done anything to curb inflation, which was the reason we were told it was being done?
Just to clarify my comment about interest rates being relatively low, relative inflation. So we have an inflation rate of around, say, 6% now, and interest rates, for the federal funds rate, which is the principal target rate, is what, 4.5, 4.75? I can't remember now. Mm. So it's still below the rate of inflation, and most other short-term interest rates are still below the rate of inflation. So that's what I mean. Normally you'd see an interest rate of 1 or 2 percentage points above inflation, and we're still several percentage points below. So that's just what I mean by saying interest rates are relatively low. But we've seen some decline in the inflation over the last several months. It peaked, six months ago or so. And it's eased somewhat. It's still fairly high by recent the standards of the last couple of decades. And why that's come down, it's kind of hard to say. The economy has slowed, which is, it could be that. It could be that the Federal Reserve interest rate increases are slowing the economy. So in that sense, the policy is a success. It's kind of hard to trace the reasons why the inflation rate comes down. Raising interest rates is a pretty crude way of controlling inflation. At this point, I think we'd be much better off seeing tax increases at the federal level for people in the top half of the income distribution. But that's just politically impossible to imagine now. So the only tool we really have to manage the broad economy is interest rates, which are very inefficient, very ineffective, very unequal. But that's all we've got now. Mm.
The economy has also been losing jobs, but it's unclear how much that's affecting the situation, because, again, we're in this odd situation where supposedly there's been a stronger labor market, with workers being, having a little bit more leverage than they've had historically. We've seen strikes, a lot of labor activity. In fact, I'm speaking to you the day after the Writers Guild of America went on strike, which is a big deal here in Southern California, where I'm based, with the Hollywood industry. The Directors Guild and SAG-AFTRA may join in. And of course, we're seeing a lot of labor activity in places like Starbucks, coffee chains around the country. And yet, Google and Disney are hemorrhaging jobs. They're cutting thousands upon thousands of jobs. So tech and media, which are sort of the relatively higher paying jobs, are being cut. What does that indicate to you about the economy? Again, something to worry about? I mean, obviously for the people directly impacted, it's life-changing and devastating.
Well, I'd say one thing. We have to remember that recessions and job loss are just part of the capitalist, the charms of the capitalist system. If you, you know, don't like those things, and you don't like capitalism fundamentally. But moving on from that observation, right now, most of the job loss is concentrated in a few areas, a few of these sorts of headline industries and companies that you mentioned. We have been seeing job growth overall in the U.S. of about 250,000 to 300,000 a month, which is down from what it was a year ago, but it's still quite rapid by historical standards. It's slowing. It's been slowing every month for the last, I don't know, year or so. But we're going to get new numbers. We're going to get the April numbers on Friday, and it's going to be very interesting to see what that looks like, see if these headline layoffs are actually spreading, or if they're still isolated to a few marquee names like Google and the others. I think we're certainly going to start seeing a slowdown. It just feels that way. It looks that way. There are some leading indicators of employment are suggesting that. But it's not yet visible in the macro numbers in any significant way. It's funny too, speaking of macro numbers, you mentioned the strikes and the labor organizing, but it's just not appearing in the statistics. The strike statistics are still quite low. Unions represented the declining share of workers last year. We hear a lot of these stories, but unfortunately, it's not really showing up in a big way in the big statistics. Whether that's just means that they're not showing up yet, and they will eventually, or whether we're looking at a few notable cases and drawing excessively broad conclusions from that, it's hard to say. But yeah, it's just not there yet.
Do you worry that the economy as a whole could slide into recession this year? This is another sort of related headline that we're seeing from the coverage of the First Republic Bank being bought up by JPMorgan Chase.
Yeah, I think a recession later this year is quite likely. We've seen pretty strong interest rate increases, which usually lead to a recession. Like I said, it's not yet that high by historical standards, but the rate of change has been quite rapid. The level of change has been quite rapid. We're seeing just a general slowdown. The first quarter GDP numbers were kind of weak. Other indicators are looking weaker, suggesting slowdown. I think it's quite possible. Now, one thing that's interesting about the slowdown is that financial crises usually follow slowdowns in economic growth. People think the financial crisis happens first and then the economic problems hit, but it's usually starts with a slowdown towards almost zero growth rate in GDP. And then that's when the financial problems start showing up, because that famous statement from Warren Buffett, when the tide goes out, you can see who's been swimming without trunks. That's kind of what the effect is of a slowing economy. I think it's quite likely we're going to see something late this year. It's funny, there's this pattern historically where Democratic presidents have recessions late in their terms as they're facing re-elections, whereas Republican presidents have them early in their term, and then the recovery is fully underway by the time they face their re-election. So maybe Biden is falling into that unfortunate pattern. We'll see.
If you had Biden's ear, the ear of Democratic leadership, what would you tell them to do now? Or is it too late? Has the train left the station? What can they do to curb a potential recession, to curb the impacts of a spiraling economy that, especially if we're concerned about how it's going to impact most vulnerable Americans? Should we really consider raising taxes as politically unfeasible?
Well, I said earlier that there's
not much
we can do.
Raising taxes on the wealthy, I mean.
Yeah, I said earlier there's not much you can do to control inflation, but corporate profits have been very high. Corporations, I don't buy the argument that they're causing the inflation, but they're certainly taking advantage of it and making the situation worse. And increasing corporate profits taxes, which are extremely low by historic standards. You're just, basically as a percentage of profits, they're half what they were 20, 30 years ago. So bringing that back even to a more normal range, much less what we saw in the 1950s when it was 50%, you know, now they're like under 20% of profits are going to taxes. And it you know, in the 1950s, it was over 50%. So that's one area where it would reduce the inflationary pressures, but also be more equitable, you know, raise money from people who can afford to pay it rather than people who can't. But as far as what we can do to avoid recession, you know, one of the things, I'll say that what Biden's doing is actually addressing those issues in the longer term. You know, there's a lot of things that were wrong with the Inflation Reduction Act. It was certainly not the Green New Deal. There's just, you know, too much carbon in it and not enough alternative energy, and certainly nothing in the way of social investment, you know, the so-called care economy, which is what was in the original Green New Deal, and I think even in Biden's original intentions, but Joe Manchin would have none of it, so it failed. You couldn't get through the Senate. But, you know, that kind of long-term infrastructure investment that is being funded and is actually already happening. And the secondary spending that corporations are doing because of all the tax breaks will generate long-term economic growth, or should, if all the old rules still apply, and will, you know, do something to reduce the emission of greenhouse gases. So that is something that is good for the long term, and certainly something that we need much, much more of. We need also a, you know, better social safety net. During that COVID emergency, we had something like a civilized welfare state that lasted for like 6 months.
Yeah.
Now, with the expanded unemployment benefits, the child allowances, expanded healthcare coverage, you know, that was all great stuff. And it made people's lives a lot better. It helped keep the economy from going under, but just made millions and millions of people able to pay the bills. You know, that would be great to have that as a permanent thing if we had those kinds of generous unemployment benefits and child allowances and that sort of thing. That would be, you know, that's the cornerstone of a good, decent, civilized welfare state.
That took place under a really Republican president. And we've seen...
Yeah, it started under Trump, and then it got a second round under Biden. But you know, they all had expiration dates on them. Unfortunately, no, make that stuff permanent. Expand.
And they have the effect of stimulating the economy because people can pay the bills. They might go and spend a little bit of money, and be able to make ends meet. It can be better for collective mental and physical health.
I'm not broke, but every time I go to the grocery store, I'm like, my God, this stuff is insanely expensive, and. I'm sure a lot of people are feeling the same thing, and it'd be great to be able to have some kind of support for that that we're just not having. And then if unemployment rate goes higher, get a percentage point or two or three on the unemployment rate, then that's going to mean millions of people are going to have an even harder time. So that'd be the kind of thing that would be great, to have expanded unemployment benefits, some kind of permanent jobs program, if necessary. But God, you know, look at Congress. That's just not going to happen, unfortunately.
We shouldn't need another pandemic in order to make such things possible.
Yeah, it's one of those things. It's kind of the opposite side of the shock doctrine. This is the shock of the pandemic made the government do the right thing to some degree, for a short period of time. It'd be nice if we could do that more permanently without having mass death be the stimulus
for it. Price, right? Doug, where can people watch your listen to your show and find out more about the work that you do?
I put everything on this little blog, which is it's kind of an antique idea, isn't it? A blog, but I still have one. And everything, all my radio shows are posted there, as well as things I write. And that's LBO-news, LBO-news.com.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks so much for joining us, Doug.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Doug Henwood, political economist and host of a weekly radio program called Behind the News. He's written several books, including Wall Street, After the New Economy, and My Turn. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.